That brings us to the next chapter, which is all about the specialness of water that I was hinting about. And we can see water molecules here. Very similar drawing as the one that we saw between water and methane, only that this is all pure water, and there's more of them. But the point here is the same. When polar molecules come into proximity, they swivel in such a way so that the partially positive end of one molecule is next to the partially negative end of the next molecule. And when you have a whole population of water molecules, that means that population isn't quite as random as a population of oxygen molecules would be. Why is a population of oxygen molecules going to ignore each other? Other than bouncing off of each other. Why are they not going to be attracted to each other? I heard several answers at once, so I didn't hear any of them individually.
You said opposites attract, so would they be considered the same?
Polarity? Well, the answer is that oxygen molecules are nonpolar, whereas water molecules are polar. So there aren't these partial charges to attract each other in a population of water molecules, since water is nonpolar. Since oxygen molecule is nonpolar. Why is, though, oxygen nonpolar? There is no hydrogen in oxygen. I'm talking about an oxygen molecule. It's all right. Why is an oxygen molecule nonpolar?
The electron.
What do you mean? What do you mean? What about the electrons?
I'm bouncing off of his answer, like the opposites attract. So, like, if they're nonpolar, they're not attracting, so they must be the same.
Well, the phrase nonpolar doesn't apply to electrons. All electrons are fully charged, right? So the phrase nonpolar refers to an entire molecule or a bond within that molecule. In an oxygen molecule, which consists of two atoms of oxygen, why is it nonpolar? What about it?
There's not a difference because since they have the same.
That's right. It is true that in an oxygen molecule, the electronegativity value for one of the two oxygen atoms is exactly the same as the electronegativity value for the other oxygen atom. And therefore, what?
There's no polarity.
Well, therefore, there's no polarity, but why? What does the equality of the electronegativity values make happen or allow to happen? Equal sharing of electrons. That's what makes something nonpolar. The shared electrons in the covalent bond are equally shared. If so, it's a nonpolar covalent bond. And if a molecule contains only that kind of bond, then the whole molecule is also nonpolar. If a molecule contains polar covalent bonds, then the whole molecule is polar. We see that in water. But what makes an individual bond polar?
Having the same negativity.
No. Having the same electronegativity will result in a nonpolar covalent bond.
Then one
atom seems to be different. It's based on electrical distribution.
Not quite. What did you just say has to be true for a nonpolar covalent bond? Finish the sentence.
You said that for, like we were talking about before, it has to be equally.
Okay, let me ask it again then. What makes a covalent bond polar? If it is a polar covalent bond. No, that makes it nonpolar.
Oh, so a difference in electrons.
pretty drastic difference in electronegativity values will make for a not for a polar covalent bond, but why? What does the difference in electronegativities lead to?
Sure.
There's sharing in polar and nonpolar.
Electron pairs share unequal.
Yes. Unequal sharing is the essence of polar covalent bonds. All covalent bonds have sharing. Polar covalent bonds have unequal sharing. Nonpolar covalent bonds have equal sharing. So, of course, an oxygen molecule, which has two identical oxygen atoms, is going to be nonpolar, right? No, neither one of those two greedy oxygen atoms is going to win out over the other equally greedy one. But oxygen wins out over hydrogen in a water molecule, and that's why it's polar. Unequal sharing. Okay, so hydrogen bonds form between water molecules in a population of pure water, but between any polar molecules. They don't have to be water. And even if hydrogen isn't involved, it usually is, but even if it isn't, we still call that a hydrogen bond, which is not a chemical bond. Well, that polarity of water gives water all kinds of special properties, which is what the rest of the chapter is mostly devoted to, starting with the second slide here. Here we see movement of water through a plant, this tree, for instance. If you follow the blue arrows, you see that the movement of water is one way through a plant. We're talking about vascular plants, which nowadays is the vast majority of plants, meaning plants with vessels, tiny little straw-like vessels called xylem. Anyway, in a vascular plant, the movement of water is such that water enters the plant at the soil through the root system, and then travels up through these tiny, narrow xylem vessels upward, and then eventually exits or leaves through the leaves, the water leaves. And so it's a one-way movement continuously. And we call that one-way movement, by the way, transpiration. This is necessary to keep the plant alive because it needs water continuously, as long as it's going to live. Right? Which is why you can kill a plant by not watering it. But anyway, notice that transpiration, that one-way movement of water, is against gravity. Right? It's an upward movement. And gravity is trying to move that water in exactly the opposite direction. It's pulling it downward. So, obviously, there must be a force that's even bigger than gravity that's winning out here so that the water does move upward. And it's really an example of capillary attraction. If you have a capillary tube, you know what I'm talking about? A very thin glass tube that you put on a drop of blood. It seems like the blood just gets sucked up the tube. It moves against gravity upward.
Isn't that the same thing?
That's what I'm talking about. I wasn't talking about the blood of the tree. Yeah, just a liquid in general at the end, at the bottom of a capillary tube will be lifted against gravity through that tube. Similarly, in the xylem tubes that make up the vessels in a plant like this tree. And we're looking at a very, very close-up view here. These are individual water molecules, so this is a tiny tube. There are millions and millions within the plant. But it's capillary attraction that wins out over gravity so that it is an upward movement. And there really are two names we give to forces of attraction here, even though they're, in both cases, it's hydrogen bonding. So we just give it different names for the reason that it's based on what's involved. The two names are adhesion and cohesion, or adhesive forces and cohesive forces. Co here, just like in covalent, means share. So a cohesive force or cohesion is force of attraction between two particles of the same type. That's what the co refers to, same type. Adhesion, on the other hand, is attraction between particles that are different from each other. And both of them come into play here. The water molecules are individual molecules, of course. They're not forming a... They're forming hydrogen bonds, but that's not a chemical bond. They're still individual water molecules. But they are attracted to each other because they're polar, whereas they wouldn't be if they were nonpolar, right? And this makes this column of water that's rising through this tube very similar to a train. A train which is pulled by an engine, but all of the non-powered cars follow along because they're all hitched together, right? So this is like a train of water molecules where the hitches between cars are the hydrogen bonds I've been talking about. And each individual hydrogen bond is tiny in magnitude, but there's a hell of a lot of them because this is a very long train, trillions and trillions of water molecules. And that means as long as the ones at the top continue moving upward, then the hydrogen bonds will pull on the ones below and everything will follow. Why are the ones at the top continuing to move upward? Because of adhesion. Adhesion between the polar water molecules in the interior of this vessel and the also polar molecules making up the stuff in the walls of the tubes. So they're attracted upward if there's not already a water molecule there, and then they'll pull other water molecules below them along for the ride, like a train. But just, you know, if you imagine a real train and one of those hitches breaks, the second half of the second portion of the train is going to be left behind, right? There's going to be a gap between the rest of the train that will move on. Well, that would be fatal to the tree if there's a gap that forms because you break this water column. If you form a little bubble in it, basically, that will make that vessel useless. And if that happens in enough vessels, then there's not going to be any water reach the top, which will kill the tree. Now, this is movement of water against gravity, which takes quite a force. Now, speaking of water, if you think about water in your house, you are accustomed to having water come out when you turn the spigot on, right? If you've paid the bill. But scientifically, why does the water come out when you do that? Because it's pressurized, right? There's a higher pressure inside than outside, so it moves down its pressure gradient, the water, and comes outward. But why is there pressure to begin with? I find that most students have never thought about this, or seemingly. Why is there pressure in the water system?
It goes from large pipes into smaller, narrow, thinner tubes.
Well, it is true that that happens, but let's just imagine if you have a vat of water right here, big tube, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and nothing, you have an empty vat here. There's not going to be any pressure.
Isn't there a constant force acting on that large
vessel? Yes, and that constant force is gravity. So the reason that your water is pressurized is because most of the water in storage is higher than your house. You know, if you go to the plain states that don't have hills or mountains, you have water towers that are taller than most of the buildings. That's where the water is temporarily stored, and therefore when you turn on your spigot, it's really just coming downhill by the force of gravity. That's what causes the pressure. And around here, we put the water tanks on mesas, if you look around town. They're higher than most residences. But if you build a tall building, a skyscraper, that's taller than any of the tanks, that water is only going to go up as far as the tank, wherever the tank is, right? No higher. So how do you get water to the top of a big skyscraper? You have to have a dedicated pump using energy to force that water against gravity, which is a hell of a lot of force to get it all the way to the top. Well, a tree doesn't have such a pump. It doesn't even have a heart-like pump operating like our heart does, pushing fluids around. So it relies only on this force of attraction between water molecules. And eventually, you know, the taller you get, the more water is, the more gravity is pulling down on that whole column. Eventually, you'll get a train that's so long that gravity will win out and it will break the links and kill the plant. And that's why in sequoias, sequoia trees are the biggest, the tallest organisms that have ever lived. And depending on how you define organisms, the biggest organisms that have ever lived. They are tall as hell if you've never seen them. Much taller than buildings. And so that's an enormous force to get that all the way to the top of the tree, all caused by these tiny individual hydrogen bonds. And it's probable that they have evolved to be just about as tall as anything can be and still be able to get water to the top via this mechanism. All right, now to three. We're looking at an animal walking on water here. And, you know, if you try this, you're going to sink. But this animal gets away with it, and you can see at each of its footsteps that the water surface is deforming a little bit. It looks like there's a film of water, almost like there's a skin on the surface of the water that's different from the water at depth. And that's why he's not penetrating, or I don't know whether it's a male, that skin-like surface. Well, it's not just skin-like. There actually is a skin at the surface of water. And like all of these things in this chapter, it's due to hydrogen bonding. So if you imagine a container of water made up of trillions and trillions of water molecules, more or less equally spaced, always moving around, changing positions. At depth, meaning everywhere except the surface, each of those water molecules is more or less being attracted to water molecules around it in all directions. It's being pulled more or less equally in all directions, right? But imagine the molecules that are at the surface. They're being pulled downward because there's water molecules below them, but they're not being pulled upward because there aren't any water molecules above them. So that means the ones at the surface actually are compressed together more because of this downward force that wins out because of hydrogen bonding. And so it is actually a more dense skin-like layer at the surface, which is why the bug doesn't penetrate it. Now, it's not a permanent structure. The water molecules making it up are changing continuously as the water molecules move around. But at the surface, it will always be compressed and more dense. Brings us to four. And there's nothing special about this map, this particular location. Could be anywhere where you have a large water mass around a large land mass. But there's a couple important properties of water that this map reminds me to tell you about, a couple definitions, one of which is the specific heat capacity. Now, any given substance has a specific heat capacity. You can measure the value for it, for any given substance. But the definition of specific heat capacity is the amount of energy that's required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of that stuff, whatever it is, by 1 Kelvin, or 1 degree centigrade. And every substance has a certain value. But it's a way of numerically indicating how easy or difficult it is to heat that stuff up, right? Compared to other things. And compared to most substances, water has a pretty high specific heat capacity. It's harder to heat up an equal amount of water, an equal mass of water, than it is an equal mass of oil, by far. You know, you put in equal amounts of water and oil in equally hot skillets, and that oil skillet is going to get hot a lot easier.
The specific heat capacity is the surface, or what is
that? No, the specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of that material by 1 degree centigrade. Well, 1 Kelvin, which is exactly the same size as 1 degree centigrade. Okay, so specific heat capacity tells you how easy it is to heat and cool that substance compared to other substances. And the reason, as in all these cases, that water has such a high value is because of the hydrogen bonding. Keep in mind what temperature is, or tell me that you've learned what temperature is. What is it? Yeah, but so is time, and they're different. What is temperature? Yes, but what does that mean? Not necessarily air, whatever the sample is. Yeah, temperature is an indication of the average speed of the particles in the sample. Right, all the particles are moving at individual speeds, but if you took the average of all of them, that would be the temperature. Or you could, that's what the temperature indicates. So, think about a sample of water. If you deliver energy to that sample, so that in hopes of speeding all those particles up, before they can actually go off on their own from compared to other water molecules and speed up, they first have to break that attraction of the hydrogen bond that they have with other water molecules. So some of that energy goes into breaking them out, the hydrogen bonds, before you can really speed them up. And therefore, water is harder to heat than nonpolar substances are. It has a higher specific heat capacity. Does that make sense based on hydrogen bonding? Well, this has extraordinary implications because that means a large body of water compared to a large body of land that's getting the same amount of energy input from sunlight is going to undergo a much smaller range in temperatures from day and night. The water is going to be much more thermally stable because it's hard to heat up and hard to cool down since it has a high specific heat capacity. The land mass is going to go higher during the day just like the water does and get cooler at night, but it's going to get much warmer and then much cooler than the water. And we are terrestrial animals, so we tend to think of ourselves only and that everything lives on land, but that's only recently true. Life started in the oceans, and for billions of years, that's the only place there was any life. The reason that it started in the oceans is because it's a much more stable environment because of this higher specific heat capacity of water compared to land. Another definition, though, here is latent heat of vaporization. Once again, any given substance has a value for this, but the latent heat of vaporization is defined as the amount of energy required to convert 1 gram of that substance from liquid form to gas form. In other words, to evaporate 1 gram of that stuff, the amount of energy. And just like specific heat capacity, compared to other substances, water has a high latent heat of vaporization. No, it's harder. The higher the number, the harder it is to evaporate. The more energy is required. Now, the high specific heat capacity is what's behind the adage, a watched pot never boils, right? It seems like it takes forever for a pot of water to boil when you're in a hurry. And that's because you have to deliver so much energy just to break those hydrogen bonds before you can get them moving fast. That's specific heat capacity. When you finally, though, get to evaporation, that's also this latent heat of vaporization is due also to hydrogen bonding. So imagine this beaker again. To get from the liquid phase to the gas phase means leaving that population of molecules in the liquid. And by the way, what is the difference between a gas and a liquid?
One is in the air.
Not necessarily in the air, but the air is an example of a gas mixture. That's right. That's really the only difference. Because when you have water vapor, which is the gaseous version of water, and liquid water, which is the same exact substance, the real difference is how far apart the molecules are. So if you talk about an individual molecule, it doesn't make sense to call it a gas, a liquid, or a solid. Those terms apply only to a population of molecules or particles. Right? And that's because it's not a chemical change that occurs when evaporation takes place. You start with water, you end with water. It's just that you're spacing it out apart to evaporate it into a gas compared to a liquid. Okay, but anyway, for that to occur, going back to this population of water molecules in the liquid phase, first of all, you don't really have a chance of evaporating unless you're at the surface, right? So evaporation occurs at the surface. Eventually, though, any water molecule will make its way to the surface because they're always moving around. Now, when evaporation of water occurs from a surface, from a liquid surface, that results in the water that's left behind that has not yet evaporated becoming cooler. Its temperature will decrease. And this might surprise some of you, that will also cause the air into which the water molecule is evaporating, that will make the air cooler as well. Both the water and the air get cooler when evaporation takes place. That's right. Evaporative cooling is done several different ways, including misting systems. Now, this keeps you alive every day, especially living in Phoenix. Because it gets so hot here that our body temperature would exceed lethal limit if it weren't for the fact that we sweat, which is really just a way of delivering water to our skin so that liquid water evaporates. And that removes a lot of energy from the liquid water. It makes it cooler, keeping us alive. If you can especially notice this with biking around in the summer. It doesn't even take a long bike ride. While you're biking, even in the middle of July, it seems like it's okay. But then you get off the bike and it immediately seems like you've just started sweating because it just comes out of you. Well, you've been sweating at that rate the whole time, which is why you were able to survive that trip. That was cooling your body. But the air movement as you're biking enhances the evaporation, so you're not noticing it build up the sweat. When you get off, you're still sweating that much because your body doesn't realize that it needs to, that you've stopped, and it gives you an appreciation of just how much evaporation has taken place to keep you alive. But let's use this beaker again to explain why it cools the liquid that's left behind. So if you're a member of this population of water molecules in the liquid phase, first of all, like I said, to have a chance of going out into the gas phase, you have to be at the surface. But if you're one of those surface molecules, what has to be true of the surface molecules that have the best chance of escaping? They're all water molecules, but which ones of them will have the best chance of actually going off on their own? The ones that are moving the fastest. Exactly. They're all moving at their own speeds, right? But the ones that have the fastest speed are most likely to be able to escape that surface and go off into the gas phase. Does that make sense? Well, think about what temperature is. If you remove the fastest ones from the population, what happens to the average speed of the ones that are left behind? It goes down because you've gotten rid of the fastest ones. And what is the average speed? The temperature. When that gets slower, that means it's a cooler body of water now. That's what keeps you alive by sweating.
Is that why they have aerators and pools?
Yes, it's evaporative cooling. Exactly. That cools the water droplets before they drop back down into the pool. Now, it also cools the air. And the reason that is true is because, yes, those are the fastest ones in the liquid compartment that have left. But compared to the ones that have already been in the gas phase, a lot of those are actually slower. So that population of gas molecules, average speed, is going to go down when you add these ones that are just barely fast enough to get there. You see what I'm saying? And so the air gets cooler as well. And that's why evaporative coolers work. Not only misting systems, but if you have an evaporative cooler, it's continuously pumping water over the mats. That cools the water itself. But what you're interested in is the fact that the water, the air that's evaporating into also gets cooler, and it's the air that gets pumped into your house. It makes it humid, but it makes it cooler. All right, let's see you in the lab.